You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Worshippers stream out of a synagogue after Sabbath services, unaware that not only 100 yards away, an expert marksman and avowed racist, anti-Semite, and member of the KKK awaits, his hunting rifle ready. The October 8, 1977 shooting was a forerunner to the tragedies and divisiveness that plague us today. John Douglas, the FBI's pioneering first full-time criminal profiler, hunted the shooter, a white supremacist named Joseph Paul Franklin, whose Nazi-inspired beliefs propelled the three-year reign of terror across the U.S., targeting African-Americans, Jews, and interracial couples. In addition, Franklin bombed the home of Jewish leader Morris Amadei, shot and paralyzed Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint, and seriously wounded civil rights leader Vernon Jordan. The fugitive supported his murderous spree, robbing banks in five states, from Georgia to Ohio. Douglas and his writing partner Mark Olshaker returned to this disturbing case that reached the highest levels of the Bureau, which was fearful Franklin would become a presidential assassin, and haunted him for years to come as the threat of copycat domestic terrorist killers increasingly became a reality. Detailing the dogged pursuit of Franklin and employed profiling, psychology, and meticulous detective work, Douglas and Olshaker relate how the case was a make-or-break test for the still experimental behavioral science unit and revealed a new type of determined, mission-driven serial killer whose only motivation was hate. A riveting cautionary tale rooted in history that continues to echo today, the killer's shadow is a terrifying and essential exploration of the criminal personality in the vile grip of extremism and what happens when rage-filled speech evolves into deadly action and hatred of the other is allowed full rein. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Killer's Shadow, The FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer, with my special guests, John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. Welcome for the first part of this interview, legendary FBI profiler, John Douglas. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for this interview.
Oh, thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you so much. Let's jump right into this incredible tale. We only have you on the line for 45 minutes, and there's so much to discuss. Let's talk about first the October 10th, 1980 phone call. You were in Quantico in your office when you got the call. Tell us about the nature and the subject of this call.
Yeah. Okay, I received a call from an agent who I knew personally, Dave Cole. We were together in the Milwaukee division. We were both on the same SWAT team together. I hadn't seen Dave in a while. He's working in the Civil Rights Division. He, along with others now at headquarters, they know I've been doing this research with serial killers, trying to develop this new investigative tool, which isn't exactly everyone is welcoming it, kind of like the Mindhunter series, how they portray it. The local police thinks it's something like witchcraft, and the headquarters, you know, why are we doing something like that, interviewing, you know, people in prison? Because I came back as an instructor in the behavioral science unit teaching criminal psychology. And the reason I started doing the interviews was I wanted to be a good instructor, because the instructors, the ones we had, while they were good, entertaining, but they were getting their facts wrong, and they were being challenged in the classroom by police investigators attending the FBI National Academy 11-week program, where they took a course in criminal psychology. And I'd be auditing the class, because one day I'm going to be in front of that class, and a hand would go up to one of the instructors and say, "Hey, you got your facts wrong, man. What are you talking about?" I said, "I worked the case. You got your facts, you know." So here I'm auditing, and I say, "Holy mackerel, this is nuts." So that's when I started doing the going out doing the research. I mean, we're on the road anyway. We call them road schools for a week or two. Let's go into the prisons. Let's interview. Let's see if Manson will talk to us. Let's see David Berkowitz, Richard Speck, you know, whomever, yeah, Ed Kemper, see if they'll talk. So the Bureau was against that initially. And even when I got that call in October, Dave Cole knew me, and he knew what I was doing. So he said, John, do you think, you know, we have this case, a serial murder case. It's different than the kind of cases that you've been working. And you work on sub cases, unknown subject cases, trying to identify who's responsible. Here, we know who it is. This is a guy named Joseph Paul Franklin, this racist serial offender who's traveled all over the country. And he just escaped out of a local jail in Kentucky. We have no idea, you know, where he is, and we're about ready to make him a top 10 fugitive. So can you come up here? We'd like you to do an assessment. You think you can do it? So I said, I don't know. I'll see what you have on him. So I go to headquarters, and they give me box loads of material that I will take with me. And Dave said, you know, hey, John, you know, we're good friends. He said, don't screw up with this one, man. He said, you'll be working cattle rustling cases out in Butte, Montana, if you mess up on this one. You know, so
right.
I get the boxes, and I go through everything. And his background is very similar, very, very similar to the other cases that I was working, where you have this real dysfunction in the background. You have the abusiveness by the mother, in his case, the mother and the father, and they would beat him. He had two sisters and one other brother, but he would get the brunt of this. And he got involved in the animal cruelty and all that kind of stuff. He was bullied upon in school. And then I saw he had a physical ailment that he got accidentally when he was a youngster. He was playing with a shade on the window shade, and it was with his brother, and they twisted it in such a way where the spring flew out and struck him in the eye, struck him in his right eye. And
right.
Anyway, how's this guy? He's good. He's a sniper, and he lost his eye. And what really made it even worse for him, because I would later interview him as well, but his mother took him to the emergency room, but the doctor there said, okay, we have to let it heal a while, but bring him back in a couple of months. Well, she never brought him back, and that's how he lost his eye. And he was just angry as hell at the mother and the father, as well. So here, it's kind of interesting. You see an overcompensation for the loss of that eye, where now he gets obsessed with weaponry. He wanted to be a police officer, and when he found out he couldn't be a police officer, which is like other serial offenders do, when you ask them what profession would you like to go into, because they see it as power and over others.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up being this crackerjack shot and go to the range, and he overcompensated, you know, for that illness. And he drops out of high school, and he then he's floundering around looking to belong. He feels like alienated, isolated. You know, he's like an insignificant nobody. What can he do to become a somebody? You know, he's looking for groups. He sees groups of people that he can target that he'll, in his mind, believe that they're inferior. They're inferior to him, their religion, inferior to their race. Like so many of these groups, where you see some of these followers will join, you know, these type of organizations. And he does that. He joins the KKK and the Nazi Party and some others. But he's floundering around because he sees that the FBI, we pretty much have them infiltrated, those organizations. We have sources in them. And he also saw them as a bunch of drunks that would sit around in halls or basements somewhere, talking the talk but not walking the walk. And then based on that, he finally becomes what we call today is the lone wolf type of an offender.
Now, what does Dave Cole ask you to do? You talk about a fugitive assessment.
Yeah, it's an assessment. It's an assessment to determine, you know, there used to be a show years and years ago called "This Is Your Life," and they bring out some entertainer, and behind the screen there would be people talking about different contact they had with this person. So this is your life, you know. So what I have to do is, this is your life, like Joseph Paul Franklin. This is, you know, in my mind, what are his strengths? What are his weaknesses? What are his vulnerabilities, if he has any? Where will he go? I'm learning through the research that I'm doing with other violent offenders, both not just serial murders, but single murders, but serial rape cases, arson cases, you know, as well, looking for comfort zone area. Like you and I may have. I may have a favorite watering hole, a bar that I'd like to go to, or a place in the park where I'd like to get away from it and get away from people and feel comfortable. Well, serial offenders, they, and particularly the first cases, they perpetrate generally in areas where there is this comfort zone. The little bit of problem I had, though, with Franklin is this Franklin comfort zone, really, he was all over the place. He's all over the map. He's up in the northeast here, up around Maryland, but then he's around Midwest, and then he went out as far as California, you know, one time, and he's in Utah, killing people, interracial couples. So that's what made it so difficult. Plus, it made it difficult early on for investigators. They never even linked any of these cases together because there was just so many, and they were different weapons used, filing the ID number off. He'd even leave the weapons at the crime scene. He didn't care because they wouldn't be able to trace it. So where would he go? He said, John, we don't even know where he is, and can you come up with that? So I saw that the comfort zone would be really where he began his life. It would be in Mobile. He was a prolific bank robber down there, and never got caught for any of the bank robberies. In fact, that's how he was making his money when he was roaming around the country. He got married when he was 17 to a 16-year-old girl. That ended in a divorce after 4 months. But then when he was 27, he married another girl, 16 or 17 years of age, and they had a child together, had a daughter. And so I'm looking at him proficient in bank robberies, and also his only accomplishment in life are those kind of things, criminal accomplishments, but also personal accomplishment would be the daughter. Not so much the wife so much, but the daughter. But wherever the wife was, the daughter would be there. So where he's going to end up is going to be, what I said, went out in those days, the teletype, would be in the Mobile area. And then, so if you're going to saturate the area in Alabama, and then further south too. He was roaming around further south and even into Florida. And what was unusual, here he'd rob a bank, maybe get a couple of grand, but he would also give his blood. He went to blood donor places and would get $5, $10 for his plasma, which was odd. So that was another lead. So they went out, they saturated all the blood banks around in the deep south, gave out photographs of him. He had very distinctive tattoos on his arms that they would see when he gave blood. And so no sooner did it go out, and when the teletype, though, went out all over the country, let me tell you, I'm just starting to develop this program. If he would have, if I would have said, if he ended up in Washington and I said Mobile, you wouldn't be talking to me today, Dan, because they never would have developed this program. Because this was like a test, because the Bureau, this is like the first one for the Bureau. Now, the others right after this, on the heels of this one here. So the teletype goes out. And what was kind of funny at the time, and I thought it was kind of ridiculous, was the agent in charge of the Mobile office calls me up. He said, John, he said, we have information now. He's in our area. He's in Mobile. Ah, that's good. But what is the name of the bank? What bank and savings and loan is he going to rob next? I said, what? He wants to know. I said, that's like me providing the name and address of a serial killer, you know, in an unsub case. And I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know what bank or savings and loan. We didn't even know what city he was in. I told you what city he was going to. He's going to be in Mobile. It was kind of ridiculous. He ended up actually being identified down in Florida. Doctor did a good job keeping him there because he recognized the tattoos, called the office, and then they came over and arrested him. I gave some ideas to the investigators on how best to interview him. They were going to take him back to Utah, where he killed two African American males there, and they were going to fly him back. So they end up, it was thought of the best way to fly him back would be through a private plane and taken a long time, a long way back, because he's also afraid of heights. So we could spend a lot of more hours with him than on a private plane versus a public plane. And that's, they did that. And they got a little bit of information out of him, not a lot. It wasn't until later on, then when I got to interview him about 8 years later, because then I was shifting over to assassination research and interviewing like Arthur Bremer and Sirhan and James Earl Ray, Squeaky Fromm, who shot Ford, Sarah Jane Moore shot Ford, and then other assassin type of personalities. I was dealing with a Secret Service agent, and surprisingly, I was asked to do cases for them when I was evolving, and they never had a behavioral science unit, and they would end up sending one of their agents over, Ken Baker, to learn, to understudy us. I even had the CIA came down to Quantico to interview me at the time of what I was doing, of how, you know. And to me, Dan, it's just common sense. To understand the artist, I always say this in my other books too. To understand the artist, you must look at the artwork, and before I do an interview, I want to look at the artwork. The artwork is crime. It's the crime and how the crime was carried out, how it was perpetrated, who the victims of these crimes were here. So if I wanted to be good at anything, it seemed I should go to the people that have been successful, although they're incarcerated, so they're not 100% successful, but many of the ones have gotten away with crimes for a long, long time, and how are they able to do it, and why did they do the things they did? And I'm looking for patterns and characteristics, in their crimes, that I could apply to other cases in the future. And what would happen to me is by the time I end up retiring, I'm kind of de-emphasizing profiling a little bit in the specifics. I may give a rough profile, but I was getting more into behavior because I may miss a characteristic like a educational level. And what you're trying to do at some point, once you provide the analysis with the police, then you go public, you're trying to get lead value. And if I miss an age, if I miss an educational level, someone would say, boy, everything fits, but the guy I know, I mean, he's a lot younger. He's a lot younger, and everything else is right on the mark. So what I was 100% felt good about was behavior on cases. Not every case, but somewhere I really got a good grasp. But, what was this guy doing before the crime, the pre-offense behavior? What was that like? What did he do post-offense behavior? What would be the best way to conduct the interview? Where should the interview be done? What time of day should it be done? What should the interview room be like when you do this? So I started, I started evolving. And then I started doing all kinds of cases, public corruption cases for the Bureau, white-collar crime, and coaching others to do it. I couldn't even get involved in, like, the show is the Mindhunter show has them doing every interview. It really wasn't like that. I would coach people to do detectives or agents and select who would be best to conduct the interview. Maybe a woman detective at a certain age group should be doing this interview. So that's how it began to evolve around me. So here's something that was just just to become a good instructor. And then the next thing you know, I'm a program manager of criminal profiling. And then the next thing you know, now comes this case, Unabomber case, Tylenol murders, Atlanta child killings, Buffalo 22 caliber killer killing males, and also at the same time we had two cab drivers' hearts were cut out of their bodies at the same time, and brought in on that case, besides all the local cases. So we started off 59 cases around that time, about 59. And it was about 59 in 1979, 80 about 100. But by the time I left, we were doing 1,000 cases a year through all over the world, quite a few from Canada, of course, here, South America, Central America, over in England. So it just it really grew. But meanwhile, I was getting burned out along the way. And by 1983, I would nearly die on the Green River murder case in Seattle, Washington, just burned out, viral encephalitis, brain split, bleeding from my right temporal lobe, in a coma, actually in a hotel room floor for 3 days before they kicked down the door, and then in a coma for a week. I came home to my family in a wheelchair, paralyzed, and had to go through, I went through 5 months of rehab, and then after 5 months, back at it again, back at Quantico. Now I got the resources, I got the people, but I have to train these people, and it takes 2 years to train somebody to be any good at this. And then they're really good by 5 years, but by 5 years, a lot of them are beginning to get burned out themselves, and they want to go somewhere else.
Your assessment, your fugitive assessment of Joseph Paul Franklin was quite accurate, and so this case was a make or break it case for your unit, and it made your unit, didn't it?
Yeah. It was. In fact, it wasn't even a unit then. It was just I was just a program manager with really no people. You know, that was my program. I was it. I was doing a little bit. I was doing teaching and this, and eventually I would be taken out of it altogether. There was a unit chief, and there was 8 instructors. But the 8 instructors were teaching, you know, other things. They were not just criminal psychology, you know, practical police problems. I mean, it's just police stress, things like that. Just there was an agent dabbling in this, an old timer dabbling in this, but he never. Really, never went out and did the interviews and did the research. And what happened was that Dr. Ann Burgess, you ought to get her on your show sometime. She's the Mindhunter series. She's the would be the nurse, but mm-hmm. she does a lot of testimony in crimes against victims. She's done a lot of academic books. She's doing a trade book now. But we did like a book together on sexual homicide patterns and motives and the crime classification manual. But she is not. She's not like the character David Fincher, the director, developed on Mindhunter. She was not telling us how to conduct investigations or how to do research. She wouldn't do that. She helped us develop the computerized instrument, an interview form. It was 57 pages long, thousands of questions that we had brainstormed sitting around a dining room table up in West Newton, Massachusetts, and we sit there. And everything pertaining to the victim, to the crime itself, to the offender, and all the questions around the victim and this subject and early childhood and all that. And we would fill that form out. And unlike on television, well, they hadn't even gotten to the form yet on the television, but we didn't go in with tape recorders. I only did that once with Ed Kemper, because if you go in with a tape recorder or you're taking notes even, they're very suspicious. What are you doing? What are you writing down? Who's going to see these notes here? You know, because even some of them, too, for the heinous crimes they perpetrated, some of them think they still can get out of prison. So they're just so paranoid. So we did it once. Because since the show Mindhunter, you can't believe, Dan, how many people have called me, John, we can make a show, TV show, with all those tapes of all those people you interview. Yeah, and I'm sorry, there's no tapes. There's only one little tape of Kemper.
That's right.
That we did, but we didn't use them. And as far as the form, fill out the form, we would fill out the form as much as we could with the background, basic stuff, before the interview. And then we'd ask the questions, but we have to memorize, you know, what that form was like and what the questions. And so after we completed the interview with the subject, we then would go back to the motel, hotel, whatever, and we'd fill out the rest. We'd fill out the rest of the forms of the 57, and that was the data that we would turn over to Dr. Ann Burgess at Boston College to crunch the data, you know, on these, on these people.
You utilized your psychological background to have an approach when you put those or when you advised those detectives when they were transporting Franklin on the plane. Everything from, like you say, to make the route as long as possible.
Yeah.
And your ideas about pressure. Tell us about how you utilized the media in not only the Franklin case, but in other cases, how you utilize the media to increase pressure, but also the Son of Sam approach in interviewing.
Yeah, it was one of the things we found. It's a good question, Dan, because one of the things we started finding out is many of these offenders, obviously, they follow the media. And you get people like Son of Sam, when I did the interview of him, he did not realize how famous he would become. He'd become the Son of Sam. And when I interviewed him, I actually brought a New York Daily newspaper. My dad was a printer and president of a typographical union up in New York, and had his headline of Son of Sam terrorizing New York City. And I said, 100 years from now, Dave, and I whip out the paper. No one's going to know John Douglas or Bob Ressler here, my FBI partner, but 100 years from now, everyone will know you, David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam. So what I knew from him and others, they follow the press. And if they follow the press, that's a good thing. What you do is to try to create pressure, through the media, on the subject. I may be able to get a subject to inject himself into the police investigation. I've done that on several cases. I can just give you a quick example. Out in San Diego, there was a guy who was arrested. This was the crime. A woman ran out of gas along a highway. They would then find her abandoned car and find her up in his foothills with a dog collar and a chain around her neck, and she's been sexually assaulted and murdered. Got the case from the police, and I told the police, okay, this is what we're going to do. Because where this happened, this occurred, there's traffic there. I want to give this guy the impression that someone saw him at that car. So for the first,
right.
So then what I have to do, Dan, is get with an investigative reporter, one who works with police we can trust, and so bring that investigative reporter in, and the first article would be something like, we're going out to the public that this woman, she ran out of gasoline here, she was found murdered, and we are hoping that people would have noticed this person alongside of the highway stopping to help this help this woman out. So you go out with that, then we're going to follow it up with, we're getting very, very good feedback from the public. We appreciate the help, something along that line. And then you come out with another one that now we've come up with, finally have a description of the car, description of that of an individual that that was there, but we don't know really if this person is involved in the case or happen to go by or whatever, because I knew that would have happened. I knew there had to be traffic there. He saw traffic there. And so but the long and short of it is that he injects himself into the police investigation, but they were ready for someone to inject himself into the police investigation. He looked for a legitimate way to put himself there. I was driving by and I saw this woman off the side of the highway. She looked distressed, and so I pulled over. Apparently she ran out of gasoline. I offered to take her to a service station, but she said no, thank you, and I went on my merry way. Well, it turned out that was the guy. That was the guy. Now I then brought up to FBI headquarters, the internal affairs, called OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility. I sit down with a bunch of lawyers, and they're ready. They say, "John, you're not. Are you lying to the press? Are you lying to the press? And what are you talking about? Are you providing false information?" I said, "Well, wait a minute." I said, "Let me tell you about the case." They weren't aware of this case that I had just done. They were talking about other cases. I said, "This is what I did, and this is what happened." And they look at each other, and they said, "Well, if this ever backfires, we're going to have your head. I mean, why? What am I doing this? That's wrong here." So you always had to fight within the FBI. And we always had the expression, ask for forgiveness rather than permission, because you have analysis paralysis, and you never get anything done. So there's some high risk. There's some high risk, but you put pressure on someone, just like Bundy, when he was a fugitive, top 10, he was pressure on him. He broke down, but unfortunately he's breaking down and he's killing, but he's leaving evidence, all kinds of evidence, behind. He would, subsequently be, apprehended.
You have the confession gained by those detectives, but there were still cases that people believe that Joseph Paul Franklin was responsible for. And,
right.
And we also haven't talked about why he changed his name and the reasons behind that as well from James Vaughn. But let's talk about that.
Well, as far as the name change, he didn't want anything to do with the Vaughn family. His name, James Vaughn, he hated his parents, so he changed his name. He was thinking about going to Rhodesia to kill people over there, fighting these wars. So he needed a name change. But he took the name Joseph Goebbels, propagandist for Adolf Hitler. Joseph Goebbels, and they took the name Franklin for Benjamin Franklin, thing as a great patriot, sounded good to him, so he then put it all together of Joseph Paul Franklin.
And we talked about the confession that was gained by those detectives, but there were other crimes that people felt, police felt, and FBI felt, that he was responsible for. You didn't get to speak to him until after he was in prison for 8 years, so in the interim...
Yeah.
What did you learn and what was suspected of him? And then we can talk about when you finally do get to interview him.
Yeah, he was, there were so many other cases around the country. And he was, in fact, they didn't even prosecute him on some of the cases, like the shooting of Larry Flint, the shooting of Vernon Jordan, civil rights leader, and there were others. They believe there was something like 20 plus homicides, and it could have been more. And what's difficult, Dan? First, when they finally go for the case, which case is they look for the case that's going to get him the toughest penalty, and that the death penalty.
Sure.
And that was the one in Missouri where he shoots a man coming out of a Jewish synagogue, and that's the one that's going to get him the capital punishment. What was the rest of it? I lost my train of thought, Dan. What was the other part?
Well, the
linkage of case. Well, yeah. The thing about there are probably cases beyond just the 2021 or cases they suspected in, because 1980, there's no computer system. There's nothing that can link cases together. There are 17,000 different law enforcement agencies. There's not a national clearinghouse or sharing of information. We wouldn't come up with a program until about 83, called the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, a computerized program. But here we are now, the year 2020. That program is a voluntary program. So it means is that not every police department is participating in that program. It's a system that's fantastic, but you have to have a mandatory. Everyone has to be participating in that program. So what made it, again, going back to the difficulty of linking him to cases, unless he's going to confess to him, which he would confess to some of the cases here, they were all just so different. He was different. He didn't just stay with one particular type of weapon. His victims were, he was all over the map as far as the cities where he was. Interracial couples, two young boys walking down the street in, I believe, Utah. He shoots and kills them. It made it very, very difficult. Today we have all the computers. We have all that, some good information. We have great stuff we can do through forensics. But we still don't necessarily have the best communication between us. And it varies from city to city, town to town, with police sharing information with other investigative agencies, and which then makes it, again, you get a traveling mobile type of offender. It's still a challenge for law enforcement.
You, to prepare for this interview with Franklin, you went and reviewed all of the material post-arrest and his stay in prison. He was right away in Marion, Illinois. What was his treatment there, and what was, as you find, a real potential motivation for him wanting to confess to crimes later on?
He was really didn't want to be in Marion. He was going to confess, hoping he'd end up in a state prison, because he knew they would be waiting for him. They meaning African American criminals in prison could be waiting for him, and they were waiting for him. He got stabbed 14 times when he was at Marion, so he started fessing up, thinking that they could get him out of there. He felt he'd be safer in a state prison, or be taken down south, you know, somewhere. But what they end up doing, they just moved him to a different site within Marion, where he had more protection with kind of like criminals, and so he didn't have to fear being attacked by the criminals in his unit. When he brought him out, we were dressed in suits. He came out in his prison garb and really animated. Shook our hands, and it wasn't that hard to get information out of him. He wanted to talk. He was very pleased with himself of what he did. He went through some of the crimes of, like, Larry Flint, why he shot Flint in his magazine Hustler. Depicted interracial couples, and that drove him crazy. He happened to be in the area where Flint was going through some trial, and learned through the media where he would go to lunch every day. And then he said he went scouted the area, and lucky for me, he said he found an abandoned building across the street from the luncheonette. And he went the night before. What he would do oftentimes is go the night before and get set up, even bring the weapon and leave the weapon at the crime scene, and he scratched the ID off the weapon. And after he does the shooting, he just leave the weapon there. He doesn't want to be seen carrying it. He covered, made sure he didn't leave any prints behind. So here comes Flint and his attorney walking down the street, and he takes a couple of shots at them, striking Larry Flint in the back, which would paralyze him. He shoots his attorney, I believe, in the back, and he will survive. He will survive that. When I talked to him, he was sorry. He just didn't kill Flint. Larry Flint. He hated the stuff he was putting in the trash. He said in his magazines, but when it was interesting, when I saw, if you go to YouTube, you can see an investigative reporter, a woman investigative reporter, talking to him just before his execution, and how bad he feels about Larry Flint and shooting Larry Flint. Sure. Well, he's full of baloney, because he feels bad about it because Larry Flint does not want him to be executed. Larry Flint is against the death penalty. He thinks that's punishment enough for him to spend the rest of his life, in prison. So he had a change of heart, Franklin, but he didn't have a change of heart when we talked to him. And he was just his planning. He got a little more better plan than earlier crimes. But like shooting the outside the Jewish synagogue in Missouri, he went the night before, stole a bicycle, drives over to the synagogue where he's going to be setting up. He sees a telephone pole. He has a spiked nail. He hammers into the pole, and he wraps that with cloth. That he's good, and the reason for that, he's going to rest his rifle, on that the next morning. He then goes away. He leaves the weapon there, hides it, and then he scoots away on his bicycle. The next day, he comes back on the bicycle, and then he sets up and he just waits. Anyone coming out of that synagogue is going to die, and so he was surprised he didn't shoot more. He said the first one he shot was his male. He came out, and then after that, he just was spraying shots all over. So there was some wounded, but he killed one. He then leaves the weapon, and he gets back on the bicycle, goes back to his car, and then he has a police scanner, which was very popular then. He's listening to the police, and the police, they're at a loss. They don't know where he is or who he is. There's no vehicle. He goes on his merry way and goes to the next city to commit more crimes. His goal was to create, he was hoping, a race war. He idolized Charles Manson. He thought it was amazing how Manson, who I interviewed, was able to have this so-called Manson family to carry out the deeds of Manson. He would have liked to have been like a Manson, but Manson was very charismatic. This guy is not a charismatic type of individual. He was a profiler in a way. He would pick up girls if see him hitchhiking, but when he got in the car, in his mind, I will decide now if you live or die. He's not telling the girls that, but he would ask questions about, hey, where are you from? Who do you date? Have you ever dated a black guy? And if they said yes, it was a girl who said she went to Jamaica and was dating a guy down there when she was on vacation. She died. Another one he picked up one time, same thing. She had a boyfriend, was black. She died. Others, they weren't so inclined to date outside their race. You lived. And so it was just a real difficult case. He would have loved being around today. I mean, what's going on, today in the internet, where you can find so easily others who have the same dislikes, whatever you're looking for, whatever your problem is, you can probably find somebody who believes the same way you believe, what you believe in. And whereas in the old days, even like the news, you listen to like the old time, like Walter Cronkite, and you got the news. You get the news in the morning at 5 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and you got news. Now you're getting all talking heads, 24 hours a day news, and you could turn on the channel whichever supports your belief system. Even in presidential election,
sure.
You go to CNN, you want to go to Fox or MSNBC, whatever. So the internet is and that makes it real tough, Dan, because you can't be surveilling every site. You can't do that, and not every person belonging to these groups are going to be necessarily violent. I mean, who knew when they were marching down in Charlottesville, was it 3 years ago, and they were chanting, Jews will not replace us, and blood and soil. This was stuff out of the Nazi Germany regime there, that one person there would jump in a car and try to mow down some people. I mean, you just don't. It's really hard. And law enforcement, since 9/11, and the FBI, whose emphasis was on international terrorism, and you only have so many thousands of agents working over 300 different violations. So you're really spread thin. So you have to really rely. You have to educate the public on different signs of like the early childhood kind of stuff like that, and how this rhetoric may become stronger and vile, and we talk about killing and becoming obsessed with weapons. You have to rely on the public to provide information, to you, and then you may have something to take a look at. It's just like a police, a school shooter. I mean, it just. There are certain things, it's not 100%, but there's certain red flags that you'll see, the isolation of a student from others, and maybe a particular type of garb they'll be wearing, and so they're totally different than the rest of the school, asocial, not antisocial, but it's more of an asocial, obsessed with violent video games, or obsessed with weaponry. I mean, you have to have, someone's got to talk to this person, but as long as you know what to look for, and teachers know what to look for, so it takes an educational program. But it's difficult, and that's, we talk about the shadow, the killer shadow. What we mean by that too is the shadow that Franklin cast. I mean, there's others, but where he left off, a kid in Charleston, South Carolina, Roof. Dylan Roof, who goes into his church, the ministers there, I think eight of his flock sitting around to a Bible class, and here he comes walking in, Dylan Roof, and he wants to join the group, and then in the middle of the lesson, he stands up and he for the 45 and he kills them all. And when I didn't interview him, but I know his background. He was not saddened by what he did. He hopes that others will carry out this hatred, this bitterness, and create this war. You know, are they psychotic or something? No, they're not psychotic. There's certainly a mental problem, but they know right from wrong. But this is their way of becoming a somebody, becoming that one grain of sand on a beach of billions and billions of grains of sand, where they feel they're nobody, they're nothing. But now they've accomplished something. They are a somebody, you know, in their mind.
Yes, and certainly Joseph Paul Franklin, the case has stayed with you as you write. It has haunted you. It has told you so much. You've learned so much from the case, and it helped a fledging BSU unit, your behavioral science unit, a foothold and legitimacy and credibility that went on to help your unit and the FBI help solve
yeah.
many of these infamous cases
yeah.
in U.S. history,
yeah.
crime history. I want to thank you so much.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're exactly right. What I was developing was like another tool in a toolbox for investigators. And that's one thing that when I was out working with police around the country, they were kind of surprised that I was always giving credit to the police. I mean, they're the ones, all I'm doing, I'm kind of helping, I'll help you. I'm helping you, I'm like a coach. But this is your case, and it made the unit very strong, where there were times where the police departments wanted to come directly to us, call us directly rather than go through the channels, and you have to go through the channels, but they really trusted us and knew that we were always trying to help them. They're number one, and so it's been very, very rewarding, and I'm still around. I'm not like a dying one of the last of the dinosaurs still around, Dan.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for
coming on, man.
And talking about this brilliant The Killer's Shadow, the FBI's hunt for a white supremacist serial killer. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, John Douglas.
Thanks so much,
have a good
Dan,
night.
For having me. Thank
Next,
you,
we'll have your true crime writing partner, Mark Olshaker, here to talk more.
Yeah, now you got
to
watch him. Sometimes he thinks he's a profiler, though, Dan. So you got to watch him.
I will watch him. Thank you so much, John Douglas.
All right, thank you.
Have a great night. Thank you.
Thank you, you too.
Let's stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. My wife, Lisa, recently received her winter FabFitFun box, and as usual, she was anxious to get and try all the items she had ordered for her box. She immediately unwrapped her white Summer and Rose cozy robe. And cozy it was. It fit perfect, looked absolutely great, and was incredibly soft, Lisa commented. She loved it. She that day, likely in her cozy robe, tried out the Daily Facial Dry Brush from Daily Concepts. For daily radiant skin, Lisa again loved it. She gets all the greatest and latest items designed for a woman's skin from FabFitFun. Now that it's drier out, with everybody being inside, Lisa's appreciating FabFitFun's products' attention to staying looking young and young-looking skin. She also really liked Caudalie Venosource Moisturizing Sorbet, a must-have for sensitive skin, Lisa agrees. FabFitFun is passionate about showcasing amazing women with 16 female-founded brands in the winter box. Choose from a super wide variety of products in which to order. No need to leave home to get these seasonal must-haves. Lisa has received FabFitFun boxes for over 2 years now, and FabFitFun has helped her discover the latest and, frankly, the greatest products out there for women. She tells everyone about the amazing value in each box. And like the Summer and Rose Cozy Robe and the Daily Facial Dry Brush. Order your winter box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the Summer Rose and Cozy Robe or the Daily Facial Dry Brush from Daily Concepts. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fadfitfun.com. That's use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fatfitfun.com. Welcome to the program, Mark Olshaker.
Thank you.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I just had the pleasure of speaking with John Douglas about this incredible book, The Killer's Shadow. Congratulations.
Okay, well, I'll try not to contradict anything he said.
Well, he said that he asked me to warn to watch out for you because he says sometimes you think you're a criminal profiler. So I said, well, okay,
yeah, well, that's true. On the other hand, I tell people and I tell him I've been tutored by the best for 25 years now. So whatever I know, I got from good authority.
Absolutely. Of course, I asked John about the importance of this case, but of course, as co-author of all of the books that John Douglas mm-hmm. has written, essentially, let's talk about what this case represented for John Douglas. How important was this case? And before we talk about much later about the effect of him overall over his career,
sure.
What this case represented.
Yeah. Well, Dan, this case was important in a lot of ways. First of all, coming as it did coming into John's purview in 1980, the profiling program at the FBI was still in its infancy, and so anything they did right or wrong was going to have a tremendous effect on its future. And up until this point, all of the requests for profiling and case consultation had come from local police departments, sheriff's offices, and other law enforcement agencies. This was the first one that came from headquarters itself. It came from the Civil Rights Division in Washington because this was a very dangerous individual who they were very afraid might be on the track of trying to assassinate President Jimmy Carter. So this really was, in many ways, a make-or-break case for John's unit and John personally to try to prove the value of the behavioral science program and to show that it could actually help in real-life situations. And as anybody who reads the book will find out, the fugitive assessment that John did basically immediately at the request of the Civil Rights Division was largely responsible for helping to bring Joseph Paul Franklin to ground and stop a 3-year spree that included at least, to our knowledge, 22 murders and plus the severe wounding of civil rights icon Vernon Jordan and Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint. There may be other cases that we still don't know about. So this was very important. And to answer the other part of your question, Dan, I think the case is important and the book is important because even though Joseph Paul Franklin was caught and put on trial and eventually executed several years ago, his shadow, the killer's shadow, still looms large in this country, as we all know. And I think one of the reasons that John was so affected by this case was this was not the kind of individual sexually motivated serial killer that you and I have talked about on this program
right.
in the past. This was somebody who had a mission to start a race war in the United States, and many people have followed him. So Joseph Paul Franklin, though dead, has many spiritual children today, including, you know, ones that have been in the news, those who marched in Charlottesville in 2017, Dylan Roof, who and so on. So unfortunately, we're saying, I mean, you know, it's in some ways we're like doctors taking on very dangerous cases. You don't want anybody to be sick. At the same time, you want to do the best you can. And this book, I think, is unfortunately very relevant today because of that.
Certainly. Why you write historically and provide that historical background. Why was it that the FBI was interested post-Hoover, or even, post-Hoover, we'll say especially, why were they interested in prosecuting the cases as civil rights cases rather than murders? What was it about the South that...
Okay, well, this is you've asked a very interesting and relevant question, Dan. First of all, for a long time under Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, I think we can say from a historical perspective, did a lot of very good things and a lot of very bad things too. So his legacy is very complex. One of the things he was very wary about was racial tension in the United States, which he, in his own paranoia, felt was communist motivated. I believe we didn't get the first African American special agent in the FBI till about 1970, which was only 2 years before Hoover's death. So I think it's fair to say that even though they did some investigating of early civil rights cases, like those in Mississippi, the three civil rights workers, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner in 1964, and church bombings and things like that, they were kind of half-hearted attempts. So the FBI really had a lot to make up for and a lot to catch up with. So by 1980, I think it was when I believe Judge Webster, William Webster, was the director. They really had a lot to make up for, and as a result of the civil rights era, they needed to be part of this. Now, what's interesting is jurisdiction. As you know, the FBI is a federal agency, and it doesn't have any state jurisdiction unless it's brought into a case or under very special circumstances, like it being a federal reservation, like an army base or something like that. However, the civil rights legislation allowed it to investigate crimes that had some kind of civil rights discriminatory or prejudicial element to them. So that's where the Civil Rights Division was coming from. And this was, as I say, a particularly urgent case because this was a very unusual serial killer in that he traveled around a lot. He had no particular comfort zone for his killings. He didn't know almost any of the people that he murdered. It was completely impersonal. Not only did he move around, he used different methods. He was a sniper. He did some handguns directly to his victims. He did several bombings. So this was a very versatile guy. And also, because he had previously threatened then candidate Jimmy Carter, the Secret Service was extremely concerned that as Carter made his campaign, President Carter now made his campaign swing through the South, that he would be a target for Franklin. So the clock really was ticking on this, and I think this was a multi-jurisdictional effort. The FBI was involved, a number of local police departments and sheriff's agencies, the Secret Service, and, you know, almost anybody you can think of.
I talked to John about how this case was a make-or-break-it case for the fledging BSU, and they were successful, and his fugitive assessment was quite accurate, and it gained the credibility that they had hoped for.
Right.
But there was also crimes very soon after, like the Atlanta child murders and other crimes that John was asked to be involved with. How much did he learn, which would have helped him later, because he didn't interview Franklin for 8 years after he was arrested. So tell us what he did learn from being involved in those historic cases.
Well, again, that's another very interesting question, Dan, because when he was called down to Atlanta, where in 1980-81, when the murders, these horrible murders of black boys and girls, mostly boys, but both were taking place, there was a general consensus that this must be a Klan-type operation. This must be an organized hate group, maybe the American Nazi Party or what it was then called, the National Socialist White People's Party. And when John Douglas and his teaching and profiling partner, the late Roy Hazelwood, who is also another brilliant profiler, went down to Atlanta, that's what they expected to find. But then when they started looking at all the scenes, they said, this is not a Klan-type operation. This does not do the kind of things that Joseph Paul Franklin was doing. There was nothing symbolic about this. There was no attempt to do this publicly as Franklin had done. There was no symbolism to the crime scenes. They, unlike previous Klan activities, they hadn't left the bodies in full view. This was no warning. And more to the point, Franklin had been a sniper, so he had done a lot of his crimes from quite a distance. He was a very good shot. On the other hand, in Atlanta, these were abductions. Clearly, these were abductions. And when John and Roy were taken around by the police to the sites of the abductions, the neighborhoods that they came from, these were almost all poor black inner city neighborhoods. And what they realized was there had been no eyewitness accounts. A white person, particularly a white group of people, as the Klan would represent, would have stuck out like a sore thumb. They would have been easily identified, and there was no such thing. So one of the things that John learned and accepted was you have to go with the evidence, not with what the confirmation bias or the particular local sentiment is. So it was very difficult for him and Roy to convince the task force and then the public that, no, this was not a hate group. This was an individual, most likely a young black male himself, who was doing this. Now, I must put in that though we definitely believe that Wayne Williams was involved and perpetrated a number of these murders, he certainly didn't do all of them. Some were not related, which also brings up another point germane to what you asked, which is the whole idea of linkage and linkage blindness. One of the most difficult aspects of the Joseph Paul Franklin case, and this was not only true for John and the FBI, but for all of the various jurisdictions that were investigating these cases, was that how do you link them? How do you link the bombing of a synagogue in Tennessee with the sniper killing of somebody else in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, for instance. So these were very difficult cases, and linkage was a big issue. And in some cases, as you know from looking at the book, some of the linkages really weren't established until Franklin had long been in prison and started talking on his own, perhaps to alleviate his boredom. He said it was to be transferred to a state facility rather than Marion Federal Penitentiary in Illinois, which he didn't like very much and thought he was in danger in. And also just for the recognition. he eventually said that he wanted to have the most murders. Plus, as we've recalled, he was trying to start a race war, so he was trying to inspire other people to follow in his footsteps.
What's established, and I thought was so interesting, is the concept of applying a pressure to understand the perpetrator so well, to understand what would count as pressure for them personally, and then utilize the media oftentimes, and John talked about a case of that. But in the Atlanta case, where it actually pressures him to alter his MO, and
right.
I'm talking about the river dump. Tell us about
right.
this concept of pressure.
Well, if you follow the behavior, if you look closely at what's going on, you first of all start to see behavioral patterns. And then cases that are followed in the media, you can then begin to understand what kind of media influences the unsub, as we call them, the perpetrator, is following. For example, in the case of the Atlanta child murders, once the medical examiner's office said that, well, we're starting to find some physical evidence, what we now call CSI type evidence, hair and fibers on some of the victims. Now, John predicted, rightly so, he said, all right, clearly the perpetrator, the unsub, is following the media. So I believe that he will start trying to dispose of the bodies in such a way that that kind of evidence, that kind of physical hair and fiber evidence, will not be available. He said, I think he's going to start dumping bodies in the rivers around Atlanta, the Chattahoochee or other rivers. And as we all know from the history of the case now, that's where Wayne Williams was eventually caught. The bridges over the rivers were being surveilled by police cadets from the Atlanta Police Department. And on the last day of what was supposed to be the scheduled surveillance, one of the cadets noticed a car stop in the middle of a bridge on the Chattahoochee River, heard a splash underneath, and that's how Wayne Williams was identified.
And afterwards, just to back things up, the profile mm-hmm. fit almost perfectly as well.
The profile fit almost perfectly, and the fiber evidence that we had that was obtained matched very closely with Wayne Williams' car and carpeting in his parents' house where he lived. So I guess the lesson in all of this, Dan, is that it's not just profiling. That's a tool, and that helps. But it's the idea of profiling and proactive techniques that profiling have taught us, along with the forensic evidence, with the out-and-out traditional detective work, with reaching out to the media to see who knows what, who's seen everything. All of those things together are what generally contribute to a successful case conclusion.
Now, in the interim, before he does get to John Douglas gets to speak with Franklin in prison,
mm-hmm.
and we talked along the way that there are forces that that prompt Franklin to start confessing at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I talked briefly to John about the preparation to be able to go
mm-hmm.
and be able to interview Franklin finally, and what some of that preparation was. But also, what was the purpose of that interview, and what did he gain, what did he want and hope to learn from this very unique serial killer?
Well, first of all, one of the aspects was that the Secret Service, believe it or not, with all of the excellent work they did, had never done a study on assassins and assassin personalities. So they actually collaborated with the FBI to conduct such a study, which would both help the Secret Service itself and also the Behavioral Science Unit, because so many killers are what we call an assassin type personality. They tend to be loners. They tend to be paranoid. They tend to be good at a particular type of killing. And in Franklin's case, he was good at several different types of killing. And so John was accompanied by Ken Baker, also deceased now, unfortunately, but a terrific Secret Service agent who had come over to John's unit to help study this. And so they were very interested in the personality. They were very interested in how he chose his victims, how he went from one place to another. They found out that and first of all, to go back to what John probably told you, is before you go into any of these prison interviews, and this goes from the first one he did with Ed Kemper all the way up to what he still does today, is you have to know the case inside and out, and you have to know as much about the offender as you can, because it's so easy for them to lie. It's so easy for them to tell you what you want to hear. He probably told you, and we certainly relate in the book about the case of David Berkowitz, the 44 caliber Son of Sam killer, who insisted that he was motivated by instructions from a demon contained in a 2,000-year-old dog that belonged to his neighbor, Sam. And when John listened to this and he finally said, "All right, David, cut the crap, you know, what's it all about?" And he admitted that it just sounded better. It gave him more of a personality, more of a an aura, which a lot of them want. And so it was important for John to understand Franklin's motivations and his background. I mean, this confirmed, for example, that, as we say, most serial killers and repeat predators come from bad backgrounds, and Franklin was clearly abused by both of his parents, came from a very poor background. And then when he was about 6 or 7 years old, he had a serious accident with a window blind that left him almost blind in one eye as a result of his mother not following up on medical care that he should have gotten. So he had a resentment, and to begin with, he had anger. He grew up in poverty. He probably, you know, we constantly talk in our books about nature versus nurture, and in the case of these kind of predators, it's almost always an intersection of both. Plus, Franklin lived in the segregated South. He was born in 1950 in Alabama, and all of these guys, and I think we can talk about the QAnon people today, all of the white supremacists, whoever you want to talk about, Dan, these are people who almost exclusively, and Franklin is a perfect example of this, have a deep-seated sense of inferiority and inadequacy, and this is warring with a constant feeling of grandiosity and entitlement, and those are triangulated by a resentment that they're not getting what the world should give them, what they deserve in life, and so they find somebody to strike out against, somebody who they perceive to be either inferior to them or manipulating them. And as soon as Franklin, who I say grew up in a very racist environment, as soon as he read Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and manifesto, he felt he had the answers. The Jews were manipulating him and manipulating people like him and society, and African Americans were inferior and in danger of corrupting him and his society. So this gave him a mission. This gave him a reason to live. This gave him a self-importance. And what John probably told you also is that Franklin joined all of these groups, like the Ku Klux Klan, like the National Socialist White People's Party, which had been the American Nazi Party, like the National States Rights Party. But he eventually left these groups because of his own paranoia and the sense that they were all talk, that they didn't want to do anything, but he wanted action. So he became a lone wolf. And one of the things that John certainly learned from the prison interview, and is still an issue today with us in law enforcement, is it's very, very difficult for us to know, to be able to predict which of these haters, which of these far right wing extremists and white supremacists are just going to talk and just going to resent and just going to carry tiki torches in Charlottesville and shout slogans like "Jews will not replace us" and "Blood and Soil," which was one of the prime Nazi German slogans, and which ones are going to evolve into these lone wolves like Dylann Roof. And what's very interesting about Dylann Roof is when he was interviewed in prison, even though he'd been given both a death penalty and a life sentence, he was not concerned about these things, because when the race war that he also thought he was fomenting, when that took place, the winners, the people who would follow after him, would come and release him from jail.
That's right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you're talking about this motivation, and obviously Dylann Roof has been inspired by Franklin, and that's what you and John write about in this book, that Franklin presents this new, you know, beyond the serial killer threat, this is a even more dangerous threat to society, especially because if the goal is to inspire, then it looks like he has achieved his goal.
Absolutely right. Plus, and if you add to that how much easier it all is to get this message out than it was in Franklin's time, now that we have the internet and so many of these sites that people can directly go to, this becomes a real issue, a real threat. I mean, one of the ur texts of the extreme right wing movement is a 1978 novel, which I'm sure you've talked about in the past, called The Turner Diaries.
That's right.
It was written by supposedly by a man named Andrew MacDonald, who was actually a physics professor named William Luther Pierce III, which shows that all of these people aren't, you know, sort of dumb hicks, if you will. I mean, they come in all shapes and sizes. And this is about a race war to overturn the supposedly oppressive government of the United States and give power to the white supremacists. Now, what's interesting is several years later, in 1989, Pierce wrote another book, another novel called Hunter, which is about a lone wolf who takes it upon himself to defend the white race and destroy Jews, blacks, and other people who are considered impure or improper or evil in some way. Obviously, this book was based on the exploits of Joseph Paul Franklin, and Pierce, in fact, dedicated the book to Franklin. So you see, there's kind of a continuation of this story. And so one of the reasons that John has been so obsessed with the Franklin story for so many years and so much more, if you will, disturbed by it than he has been even some other individual cases is because, as you suggest, this one has legs. This one has influence. These kind of killers, as opposed to, you know, the normal, if you will, run-of-the-mill, sexually oriented predator, these people have a mission, and they inspire other people with that mission. And this mission, obviously, is very dangerous to our society and very dangerous to our democratic way of life.
When John interviewed John Paul Franklin in prison, tell us some of the conversation that they had regarding that legacy that he hoped to have in society even after death. Tell us a little bit more about some
of
the conversation.
Well, I don't think he thought much about after death because it was still, even though he was, even though he had been sentenced to death, you never know when or if that's going to happen in this country.
Right.
But the main takeaway is he was very matter of fact about all of his crimes, very matter of fact about how he carried them out, not at all remorseful, and I guess he was remorseful to a certain extent about being caught. But here's the really interesting part, Dan, is that, as you know, some of his victims turned out to be female hitchhikers, and Franklin had this idea as part of his mission that it was his responsibility, his privilege, if you will, to defend white femininity, to defend the honor and security of white women. Now, however, if he would pick up a young woman in his car as a hitchhiker, he would start a dialogue with them. In other words, he would start profiling them, and he would eventually get around to the subject of interracial dating, interracial sexual or other kinds of relationships or intimacy. And if he learned that this girl or woman had had any kind of relationship with black men, that was considered a big threat to him, and rather than taking them safely to their destination, he would kill them. So in other words, he was God. He was the avenger. He was the one who decided life or death based on the behavior, and he did it all through his own kind of profiling. And when he told this to John, he was very matter-of-fact about it. This is how you do things, and this is what these girls and young women deserved if that's what they did, because one of the greatest threats to him and his kind, he felt, was the intermixing of the races. And in fact, the reason he ended up deciding to shoot and try to kill Larry Flint was not because he was against pornography. He had a large pornography collection and was a great consumer of pornography. What he objected to was when he saw an issue of Hustler magazine that had a pictorial showing relations between an interracial couple.
It was strange as well, though, that he believed all of this to be in line with his Christian beliefs.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he certainly didn't think he was evil. He thought this was a mission. He believed in the Bible. He believed in revelations. He believed that Christ was telling him to do these kind of things. You know, he went back to the old trope that if God had meant for the races to mix, he would have only created one race rather than three. So yes, he was, aside from, you know, all of his psychological compensation, as I say, for his sense of inadequacy, he felt that he was very much justified and religiously motivated by what he did and the number of escapes he had. He had several escapes, as you know, and the number of times he got away from close situations where if luck had not been with him, he would have been captured. He chalked this up to Jesus wanting him to get away. The other thing that's interesting is among his other talents was he was a very proficient bank robber. But he was not interested in the money for itself, the money he used to support himself, to support this mission he was on to create the race war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. John tries to sort of, I guess, not break him, but sort of get to him. And the only way that seemed that he could do that was to mention his ex-wife, Anita, and his daughter.
Correct.
And his daughter, Lori. And so
right.
what was the – and John said he almost had sympathy for Franklin when he mentioned this. Tell us about what he thought was just a pathetic request.
Yeah, I think – well, what had happened was Franklin was married twice, both times to women younger and weaker in both mentally and emotionally to himself. And he never had any relationship with his daughter. But as he got older and he was in prison for many years, he started to feel the lack of any kind of human contact. And John figured, rightly so, that the only thing that would mean anything to him was this kind of contact. So John was not. So John had a camera with him in the interview, and Franklin asked if John would take some pictures of him and send them to his daughter. John agreed, and then was and thought that he would, you know, didn't know what kind of pictures he would want, but he was surprised when Franklin just started doing these, you know, like bodybuilding and self-defense poses. In other words, this daughter who he hardly knew, this was the kind of image that he still thought, after all these years, should appeal. This was the way he wanted to be portrayed. And then what's also very interesting is, I don't know if he mentioned this, but Franklin continued to write letters to John after this interview. And in one letter, He responded to something we'd written about the Scottsboro Boys case in a book, and he said, well, you know, you can say what you want, but how would you feel if your daughter was attacked by all these, you know, N-words and all of that? And this was a time when Franklin was already proclaiming that he'd seen the light and he, you know, didn't have any hate in his heart anymore, but this letter certainly showed that he still did. And another letter he wrote to John, which really was kind of pathetic in its way, except for the fact that this guy was such a monster, is he asked John if he could try to locate Franklin's ex-wife just because he wanted to have a relationship with somebody. So, yeah, there are these little human twinges, I guess you could call them, if you will, but he kind of, you know, remained, despite what he told people, and kind of an unregenerate monster and hater, you know, till his dying days.
John writes that this case has haunted him, but it also invaded his own personal psychological space and
sure.
and his family's
sure.
as well. Can you
yeah.
explain that?
Well, I think for the reasons that we talked about, that Franklin was not just evil, and you know we could argue for hours about the meaning of the word evil, but let's just take it on its face value and not get either religious or psychological about it. But he was not only evil, but he was influential, and that's the thing that bothered John so much, that he had these feelings, and that these feelings were the same as so many other people had. And as we've said, John really never figured out, and to this day we still haven't, how you distinguish the hater from the lone wolf, somebody who evolves into the kind of person who's going to take action on his own and do horrible damage, as Franklin did. And so this is one of the things we're still working on, and I don't know that we'll ever have an answer to this. And you know, one of the things that really bothers us is that in the last number of years, particularly during the last administration, a lot of these people have really come out from under the rock, and they've had many opportunities to do so. So I think which is why we're so glad people like you are publicizing this book and this concept, because we think we really have to be continually vigilant and always aware that these kind of people are out there.
It also, Franklin represents, even though it's happened long ago, that it seems, with the examples you give, that there seems to be, for John and yourself, obviously, a very disturbing trend in murderous behavior in this direction, in this very disturbing direction.
Yes, I think there is. And, you know, look, Dan, you and I have talked about this before. We all have these feelings of what we call the human condition, love, hate, jealousy, revenge, envy, you know, ambition, whatever. But most of us are able to keep them in some kind of check. We have filters and we have limitations on ourselves. When you find somebody like this who has no limitations, who has this anger, who has this sense of inadequacy that can only be fulfilled by this kind of murderous action and hurting other people, that's a very dangerous phenomenon and one which, as you say, we're seeing more and more of in more obvious ways.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Mark, for coming on and talking about the killer shadow, the FBI's.
Well, it's always
supremacy.
A pleasure, Dan. You're a great interviewer, and you know as much about this subject as anyone. So it's always a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's a privilege to have you and John come on and talk about this very, very important book, The Killer Shadow. Thank you so much. This book is available everywhere, obviously. I remind people that you're also the co-author and John Douglas's true crime partner, Mindhunter, Whoever Fights Monsters, The Killer Across the Table, The Anatomy of Motive, Journey into Darkness, Obsession, and The Cases That Haunt Us. Thank you so much,
wow.
Mark Olshaker.
Yes. Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Thank you.
Stay well.
You too. Good night.